me, the speed up is infinite because we get divided by zero. Yes. I would not have written this code without the AI help.
Exactly.
There's a big disruption, loss of productivity. And my conclusion out of that is the supply chain expertise needs to be continued to develop.
Maybe if stock prices relax some, that bond yields would go down has not manifested because more volatility was introduced to the system.
Yeah, the enduring importance of Intel.
Exactly.
But yeah, Intel has always been two different companies, the manufacturing fab company and the chip company. And the manufacturing one was always just about the only hope of Western civilization.
Welcome to the OrionX Download Podcast. Join Shaheen Khan, the OrionX analysts, and special guests as they discuss and simplify the big ideas and technology that are changing the world. Thank you for being with us.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the OrionX Analyst Roundtable, which we fondly call ART because it is. And this is Shaheen Khan, and with me is Adrian Cockcroft, Stephen Perrineau, and Chris Krull. Gentlemen, how are you?
Yeah, doing well. Dialing in from St. George, Utah this time.
Oh, brilliant.
Good to be on with you.
We have our global team scattered around fine places around the world. But without further ado, so let's start with what's on everybody's radar, which is tariffs and the uncertainty that they generate for every company and also the exceptions that exist for the technology market and what strategies folks might take to deal with it. Anybody want to go first?
I'll jump in because when tariffs with China were a topic several years ago, I was at a small company that had a small manufacturing company that sourced product from China. And that was the target, of course. And it caused a lot of disruption to us and to our competitors and to others in the tech sector, because all of a sudden we're having to figure out how to bring in product via Taiwan that wasn't necessarily there. Anyway, it was a big disruption, and I observed the loss of productivity. And my conclusion out of that, I would think that this time around, is the supply chain expertise needs to be continued to develop at various companies. And I see an opportunity for experts in that field. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, the Apples of the world will just be fine given their operational excellence. But it's a disruptive force when there isn't predictability.
My sort of very general comment about this is that there's all kinds of risks in international trade, and people hedge for the different risks that they see. Like exchange rate volatility is one of those ones you always look for. But tariffs generally change slowly and with a lot of signaling up front. Things like, you know, there are whole lots of discussions and whatever, and you kind of get some signals they're coming. But what we've had recently is very rapid changes and very up and down and a lot of uncertainty. So I think that that is something that even if the tariffs go back down to zero, the uncertainty, and they could change again, is now very high. So I think that people are going to factor in a lot of hedging and risk avoidance just around the unpredictability of the markets. That's a change that will take a long time to subside. If we get a period of stability, it's going to take a long time for people to really trust that stability is back.
I will just add that the instability in terms of the level of tariffs and also supply chain disruption, that's not the only instability. It also has triggered other instability in the capital markets, and in particular in the exchange rates. And we've seen an unusual behavior where the US dollar has gone down. And the thought that maybe if stock prices relax some, that bond yields would go down has not manifested because more volatility was introduced to the system. So people have to now contend with not only supply chain disruption, but uncertainty around exchange rates and just general volatility and Forex.
A lot of what's going on really is a lot easier for larger companies than smaller companies, and especially super small companies, the mom and pop store, so to say. They're the ones who are going to have difficulty if they actually directly import. I'm seeing four or five dimensions of how people are reacting to it. One is compliance, and that requires legal advice. The second one is, where are you in the supply chain? Are you downstream from those who have to deal with it, in which case you're sort of just waiting for them to manage it? But that leads to your materials flow. And how do you route your materials around the different countries and different tariffs to optimize the situation for you and do it in a legal way? Like, just shipping something to another country doesn't change the origin of the product. You have to add substantial value to it or transform it in some ways. I see companies struggling with getting pricing from their suppliers because the suppliers don't know what their prices could be. And there's also an interest in people to increase inventory for the future. So they may not want to part with the inventory that they have. And then how do you communicate that with customers? Do you have a line item that says tariffs, or do you just treat it as cost of goods sold? And uncertainty requires agility. So that leads companies to have cost agility and revenue agility. If there is a bucket of revenue somewhere, maybe you want to redirect your efforts there. There's also the notion of what's going on globally. Europe is doubling down on defense spending, so one can expect to see growth in Europe. India seems to have a special position in this global scene by not being directly involved with the big global supply chain fragmentation that's going on. So the expectation is that they will continue to grow. There's also the expectation that the US should be at least viewed cautiously, if not expected to experience market weakness.
There's this issue of what problem is trying to be solved, because there's something called Triffin's Dilemma, which has been known since the 1950s, that if you're the global reserve currency, you cannot simultaneously have an open capital account, floating exchange rates, freely floating exchange rates, and run a trade surplus or even be in balance. So you end up taking on the responsibility of providing liquidity for global trade to the rest of the world. And that is, if you want to, you know, have open capital account and floating exchange rates, you do, because you can't have all three. And so what happens is the offset of that is capital flows back into the US. And that can actually be a very good thing, right? That we're attracting capital from all over the world and have done so for a long time. So if the problem was to try and get interest rates lower, that's not what's happened. And in fact, more volatility has been introduced in that aspect of things and in the exchange rates themselves.
Your mentioning of what is the goal, Steve, is something to think about, because there have been activities or actions taken to try to bring back those aspects of manufacturing or intellectual property development that are crucial to national security, which is great, but we need to think broader than tariff as being the only tool in the tool chest for making those things happen.
Something that's driving all of this, of course, is chips, high-end chips, and AI, and the imperative that is to lead in AI. There was news that TSMC is expecting to go live with their 2-nanometer technology, the latest greatest, in Taiwan the second half of this year. There was news that Intel with their 18A fab, 18A pointing to 18 angstroms, but kind of the same zone, 2-nanometer technology. And those labels are just brands at this point anyway, that they're going live with their 2-nanometer class technology in Arizona later this year. So it sure looks like Intel is catching up with the leading edge, as their previous CEO, Pat Gelsinger, was planning to.
What you're showing there, Shaheen, is highlighting the importance of domestic supplier like Intel and the value that that company brings, even though they've tended to be overshadowed in recent years.
Yeah, the enduring importance of Intel.
Exactly.
But yeah, Intel has always been two different companies, the manufacturing fab company and the chip company. And the manufacturing one was always just about the only hope of Western civilization. So it was always in my mind a race between, you know, does Intel regain its mojo faster or does TSMC become an American company faster?
Yeah.
And both of them are sort of happening. But it is interesting to see Intel also with their new CEO, Lip-Bu Tan, carried on with Altera, their FPGA arm, becoming a looser connected entity. So they sold 51% of that to Silver Lake a few weeks ago. They took a haircut in the process from the time when they acquired it. They acquired it for something like $16 billion. They sold 51% when the enterprise value was half the price of what they'd bought.
The other thing I heard recently was that there may be some layoffs, like 20% layoffs coming.
There's an announcement.
Go by. It's been announced.
Looks like it's announced. Yeah. Well, according to a report by Bloomberg.
Yeah, I think I saw that sort of on Bloomberg. The thing is, the third thing that Intel has been working on more recently is software. And I think this is one of the things that NVIDIA has got good at. NVIDIA is a chip company, but they have very good software that works. That means you can use their chips. One of the reasons why NVIDIA has been successful is because of their software investment, and Intel has been trying to do that. So if they're cutting back, I'm interested to see what they're cutting back. And are they giving up on software or are they investing in software as an enabler for the future?
NVIDIA has been amazing in how they've transformed themselves into higher and higher levels of the stack in an effective way. The rule of thumb in Silicon Valley was chip companies will never know how to do software. And they've been getting proven wrong. And of course, being able to do software is now mandatory for any organization, I would say. So maybe some of that was just a big tectonic shift towards software that everybody had to do and eventually get. So the other thing that's going on in the global scene besides AI chips is money. And you mentioned, Steve, the Triffin dilemma, which totally makes sense. But that is a good segue into money in general and Bitcoin, which you follow closely. So let's do a quick update on what's going on in the Bitcoin world.
Well, Bitcoin prices had run up last year because of the ETFs around this time, because ETFs were introduced at the beginning of last year. Then there was some fallback, and then they ran up again around the time of the election, particularly because there was some excitement around a strategic Bitcoin reserve for the U.S. Treasury. It's taken a while for follow-through on that, and we've had some fallback in prices because global liquidity was down in Q4, but it picked up again in Q1, and it tends to have a one-quarter lead relative to Bitcoin price action, and we're seeing a pickup in prices, particularly in the past week, as a result of some backpedaling on the tariff plans, and there was some discussion, shall we say, about the Federal Reserve Chair, and then some backing away from that too. So Bitcoin responded favorably, and gold has been doing as well. It's part of what I just mentioned before, this uncertainty in the foreign exchange markets, and more discussion about what is the status of the dollar as the ultimate reserve currency for the globe, and whether there's any threat to that, and potential replacements are few. And Bitcoin is one that sometimes gets mentioned. The U.S. has now decided to have a strategic Bitcoin reserve, and the administration moved the 200,000 or so coins that are in the Department of Justice. They're moving those over to the Treasury. And then there's a bill in Congress that would add to that. It would need to be done in a revenue neutral way, but there's a scheme to revalue the gold reserves and to use the mark to market apparent paper profits as a way to fund some of that. Another big announcement this week was 21 Capital. And I'm being careful because I know a very small outfit that does consulting on Bitcoin, and they have a very similar name. So it's 21 Capital, and it's a three-way partnership between Cantor Fitzgerald, who are a very large prime broker in New York, and then SoftBank and Tether. And Bitfinex has a role, and they're raising several billion, I think of order 3 billion initially. And the plan is to purchase 42,000 Bitcoin for their treasury and become a treasury development company, and basically following the strategy pioneered by Michael Saylor over the past 4 years, which has led to him accumulating for his company well over 500,000 Bitcoin. And so they're going to pursue that same strategy, and they'll start out 10 times smaller, but that's a pretty substantial set of players. And they've named Jack Mallers as the CEO. He's a young guy, very strong Bitcoin background, and has implemented Strike as a solution for global payments on the Lightning Rails, the second layer of Bitcoin. So that's the most interesting development, I think, this week.
So this building of all this fintech around Bitcoin, and of course, the industry has been building fintech around crypto in general for the past 10 years, with just coming from all various directions. And we've gone through all of that history. And every time something new comes in, whether or not it's a fad, it generates a bunch of software that algorithms that solve certain problems that can be used later for something else, whether it's in gaming or NFTs or whatnot. So we are seeing all of this get built now focused on Bitcoin. What is your take on that? Is this starting to take shape as a mini industry that is identifiable by itself, or is it still projects here and there?
Well, I think Bitcoin has been waiting upon scalability for payment solutions. So a lot of activity in crypto has been with other base chains, whether it be Ethereum or Solana or others, to try and develop fintech solutions around there. And of course, they've been quite successful at kind of creating products. Those products, though, have been mostly speculative products. They really haven't been things like transformative products for supply chains. There's certainly been some financial activity in terms of, okay, we're going to issue a bond and we're going to put that on the blockchain. But I think that's been done kind of in parallel with traditional methods, not really replacing traditional methods. But still, all this software gets developed, and a lot of it in principle can run on Bitcoin as well on others. But the Bitcoin developer community has been more cautious because they've always prioritized security and making sure that there's no threat to the implementation of a completely finite supply, which is something that's almost unique to them, apart from a couple of hard forks. So the contracts in the Bitcoin space have had pretty limited functionality because they didn't want to have more attack surfaces, basically, for smart contracts. And so they're not Turing complete, whereas Ethereum and others have kind of opened up to all kinds of approaches with smart contracts.
So speaking of smart contracts, one question I've always had, consistent with what you have been saying, is the Bitcoin chain itself has a very, very rudimentary language that not even really, you can't even call it a language, can you? But it offers very few operations that one can do. And the perception is that that's too limited to really build anything around, and you need some language that's more capable. And now people have been focused on Turing complete languages that allow you to do anything you want, but then you can't verify the resulting programs always. So verification becomes an issue. So where does that stand right now?
You know, I think it's relatively slow. I mean, there are extensions that have happened. Taproot is one of the most important ones. Things to support multisig, for example, and things to support time locks so that contracts can have delayed outcomes and the like. But they've been done in a very gradual way with small additions of opcodes. Another one that's going to be on the horizon will be protection against quantum computing, and there's a proposal there to make things quantum safe. So it's been quite gradual. And I think the reason is that the market pressure has not been there for payment solutions. Bitcoin is still primarily in its store of value phase. And because the value is rising quite rapidly, why do you want to spend it? There are thousands of ways to spend money, right? But there are very few ways in this world that has inflationary fiat, that has increasing debt, that has poor demographics in developed countries that only aggravates the increasing debt, and it has thousands of cryptocurrencies that will allow you to spend freely and rapidly. And so actually, its uniqueness as a store of value is what sets it apart and is the reason why it has captured the majority of the value. If you set aside the stable coins like Tether and USDC, it's captured nearly two-thirds of all the value, despite there being thousands upon thousands of cryptocurrency.
There's also some news about pricing in the software as a service world, and specifically for AI, with the assertion that the existing pricing that we see in the market is unsustainable, because the companies providing it are spending a lot more on the infrastructure than they are able to charge for it right now. So where's that going to lead? Chris, you had a comment on this in our pre-call.
Yeah, so I think we'll see a tiering of pricing. In thinking about the $20 per month mark, which seems to be the place, the expectation that has been set. So it's hard to move off of an expectation that's been set without losing a pretty significant portion of your user base, especially in the consumer segments. Now, one thing that I've been thinking about is we're seeing AI capabilities being built into so many other tools and platforms. So maybe with a dispersion of AI capability, the major AI players are able to keep their price points and make money from AI capability being built into other platforms that serve as front ends, so to speak. So I think there's a variety of ways this could go, but once you've established free and $20 a month, it's hard to move off of that without interrupting your customer base.
Well, you can always go out of business. That'll interrupt them.
That is an option. I don't see OpenAI going out of business.
No. Actually, that's OpenAI. You mentioned OpenAI. That's a good segue into like, what are these guys even trying to do? Because my take is that people like OpenAI and Anthropic and Grok and Meta and some of these big giant players, they're really after AGI. They're not after the enterprise market yet anyway. So it seems to me that the revenue they're making from consumer on the side is really more to get the data and get the training going with their systems. And it's got other objectives rather than I need to make money off of it or bust.
Fair enough. I don't know what percentage of their revenue is venture capital versus pay to play. So,
do you guys have any take on this, Adrian?
I think there's consumer use of this. A lot of that can be handled on the free tier, really. I've never needed more than the free tier of OpenAI, ChatGPT, to do the things I want to do with it. But then when I got into a bit more coding, I found that I'm using the cursor with Claude, and I've got access to a corporate account through one of the companies I'm working with. So I've got a corporate license, and they've been rolling it out and finding that it works pretty well. People like it better than GitHub Copilot. So there's a license revenue from the corporate buyers who say, you know, we need this to make our employees productive, so we're going to come in and we're going to buy a license. And I think that's where you can get some enterprise revenue and upsell. And then also you want to pay extra for not commingling your information with, you know, basically to preserve the corporate boundaries for information, for IP leaking and things like that. So the free use, your data, whatever you say, is being mingled in to train everybody. But the corporate use, you have the firewall that basically says these requests stay within your corporate boundary and aren't used outside. So I think that it does make sense that there's a significant amount of enterprise revenue, even for just the general advice chat kind of things, because you'll be asking about how do I format the latest sales numbers into a spreadsheet or something. You don't want those numbers to get outside.
Steve, you've been using AI too.
Yes. Well, I think $20 a month is incredibly cheap, less than a dollar a day for what it gives me in terms of coding and other functionality in support of what I do. And the productivity enhancement is more than a factor of 10. I mean, frankly, I hadn't done any coding in decades, right?
And for me, the speed up is infinite because we get divide by zero. Yes. I would not have written this code without the AI help.
Yeah, so exactly.
The zero lines of productivity, or I wanted to make a change to some code yesterday, and I just it took me as long as it took me to write down what I wanted. It generated it. It worked. It took me a minute or so to rewrite this thing that I've been working on. So it's super productive and able to. I'm doing sort of data analysis kind of things. And for that use case, it's extremely useful and productive. If you're modifying a critical piece of code that runs something, and you've got some legacy things in there, you have to be a lot more careful. But it's certainly speeding up a lot of people and getting people back into coding that haven't been coding for years.
One other topic we talked about, and then we can close this one, was energy, carbon reporting, all of that. Adrian, that's something that usually take a close look at.
Yeah, there's a couple of things that have happened recently. Actually, yesterday, AWS finally did an update to their customer carbon footprint tool. This launched back in 2021, 2022, I think, when I was still at AWS. I helped get the thing over the line to get it launched, and then it just sat there. They finally added a bit more resolution to the data. You can get data on a per region basis, but they also changed their methodology in a way that's interesting. They now take all the unused capacity in a region, which still has a carbon footprint and which has to be there so that you can use the region. And then they allocate that proportionally across the customers. So now when you look up your carbon footprint data from AWS, it's not just the carbon footprint of the things you're paying for. It's also the carbon footprint of the things you didn't pay for being smeared across everybody. And one of the ones I looked at was almost double the carbon footprint number using this methodology. And that aligns with some international standards and things, but it's an interesting take because it means, I make my stuff more efficient. That frees up some capacity in the region. But if that capacity is just sitting there, the cost of that capacity in carbon anyway will be sort of smeared across all the customers that aren't currently using it. So that was one thing. That announcement was yesterday. I've been waiting for that for a long time. They still don't have scope 3. The other thing is the work I've been doing with the Green Software Foundation. We're wrapping up one project, at least, that I've been working on for a long time with the Cloud Carbon, so the real-time cloud project. We've got a standard there. We've said it's graduated. We're putting a V1.0 and tying a bow on it and saying this is a stable interface where you can go to the GitHub site for Green Software Foundation, real-time cloud. There's a couple of CSV files there full of useful information that we now have a stable format on that we've settled on. So we're defining our V1.0 on that. So that's sort of wrapping things up. We'll move on and do some increments on that. But then there's a new project starting off, which is looking at interfaces within the data center for optimizing carbon. And there's a project called Mycelium that's being floated. But what it's really doing is looking at, well, you've got your cooling system and you've got your power delivery system and you've got a bunch of batteries and you've got a bunch of diesel generators and you've got your telecom network capacity. All of these things are operating as silos that don't talk to each other. What they're trying to do is come up with APIs that let you gather all this information together and then do optimization for the data center itself and its interactions with the outside world. And some are going back to AI. If you start up a big AI training job in one of these gigawatt-sized data centers, the instantaneous power pull from the outside grid can be hundreds of megawatts, like almost like turning on a light bulb kind of level. It spins up pretty rapidly. So you want to be able to signal to the outside world that, you know, the lights are going to dim in the neighborhood in half an hour. So you better start spinning up, you know, make sure you've got some battery capacity charged up to supply it. Things like that are happening.
Yeah, you almost want like an ERP system just within the data center.
Yeah.
There was some threat to do this some years ago. I don't think any of them really panned out. And I think some people even call it like a data center. It can't be called an operating system. It's more really like a management administrative layer, isn't it?
Yeah, this is kind of the standards are needed to have the APIs so that you can go and build those things, right? Mm-hmm. The things get built. But the problem is that there is no standard and everyone's building their own individual siloed tools that don't talk to each other and everyone's doing it over and over again. There's a few interesting people in here. They're going to have a workshop in a few months where they're going to gather together requirements and try and come up with something. There's a lot of work to be done in this area, but it's being driven largely by this rollout of very large data centers, and particularly data centers that have a measurable impact on the systems around them. Cool stories about things that have happened in that area. That's stuff going on in the GSF. It's like a side thing for me to contribute to the standards processes there.
That's awesome. Any final comments before we close? We're trying to keep these shorter to our audience and keep it about 30 minutes plus or minus. Because we could go on for hours. There's an argument in favor of that as well. But maybe shorter is not a bad idea. Any other comments before we go? Mm-hmm. All right. Well, then thank you all. Thank you to our listeners. Appreciate you being here. Until next time, take care.
Bye.
Thanks all.
That's it for this episode of the OrionX Download Podcast. Every episode is posted to orionx.net and shared on social media. Use the comments section or tweet us with any questions or proposed topics of discussion. If you like the show, rate, review, and share it. The OrionX Download Podcast is a production of OrionX. Thank you for listening.